The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Good morning, Great Britain. This is TNT Radio. I'm Alan Miller. Good very early morning if you're in New York, and good evening in Australia. A big shout firstly going out to those who are in Oxford today on the Crowley Road and elsewhere giving out flyers to talk about freedom and democracy in Oxford. And similarly, a big shout obviously to everyone in Bath who just did a remarkable event. We'll be talking later about low traffic neighbourhoods, 15 and 20 minute cities and the ULEZ expansion, and why the Mayor of London doesn't seem to want to listen to democratic responses. But further, a bit about Together before I introduce my main guest, Baroness Claire Fox. So Together has as its main pillars freedom based on our democratic rights, choice, autonomy, privacy and assembly. We launched to challenge Boris Johnson's so-called Freedom Day announcement that vaccine passports would be introduced. We then went on to challenge and stop the vaccine mandates through our work with frontline staff, campaign groups and active citizens, journalists, academics and lobbying MPs and councillors, trusts, as well as social media campaigns and calls to action up and down the country and getting mainstream press. Putting the public back at the heart of decision making is a core part of our work together. We saw from lockdowns, restrictions and mandates that technocrats of all political colours champion such measures. We think we need to take back democracy and we need to do it together. Well, what does that mean? Well, as it became clear that the permanent state, a state of permanent emergency where measures are implemented ignoring so-called consultations, that whether they're about vaccine passports or low traffic neighbours, are extremely loaded to assume agreement. We think we need to make sure that the voices of local residents and businesses are not run roughshod over by councillors. That means having active local and regional, as well as national campaigns to challenge in positions that the majority do not want, and we need to do it together. Central to all of that is free speech, of course, and the rights of assembly. And two issues that have gone through their second reading this week in the House of Lords. And I'm very pleased to be able to welcome Baroness Claire Fox, Baroness of Buckley, who has been a consistent champion of free speech, as well as being a director of the Academy of Ideas. Welcome to the show today, Claire.
It's very good to be on, Alan.
Claire, talk to me first about the current situation with the online safety bill. I mean, we did just see today, for instance, in the lead of the Telegraph, that some are calling for more measures beyond the terms and conditions that currently stand to stop what is being called misogyny and hate against women. But just tell us where we've got to with the online safety bill and what's happening with this reading at the moment as you see it.
Okay, so the online safety bill was originally conceived as a bill that would be about protecting children. And I think that everybody that you talk to, you know, in the British public, but I'm sure this is international, worry about what children have access to online. And so the preoccupations and the headlines in the UK have been, for example, children having access to pornography, children having access to and being bombarded by, not just having access to, but being targeted by, for example, suicide sites. And there's anorexia, a pro-anorexia propaganda. I mean, you can't believe it exists, but it does. And so you can see that what happens is that the government thinks, oh, we'd better do something about that. It's all out of control. But what's happened is they brought in a piece of legislation that is so enormous and so expansive that it's no longer just confined to a discussion about how you technically or legally prohibit certain access to certain sites for the young, but actually will affect every adult. And, you know, some of us are saying it's infantilizing of all adults because they say that we need to be protected as adults, just like children. So that's where we've got to. One of the big, most problematic parts of the piece of legislation was this notion that the tech giants would be seriously penalized if they allowed legal but harmful material to be seen by adults. They've removed the terms legal and but harmful. Can you imagine a law that was basically making it illegal to have legal material seen, right? So there was a backlash. And that backlash has led to them removing that most pernicious part of the bill. However, all that has happened really is that they've outsourced the decision about what legal and harmful is to the tech giants themselves. And this is so ironic because the piece of legislation is supposed to be about curtailing the power of big tech to decide what we see and what we read. And they do that by giving them more power because they've said now that any big tech company should have terms and conditions that emphasize safety, and they are going to be held to account for ensuring that safety is a key function. And if they don't adhere to their own terms and conditions with an emphasis on safety, that in fact they could be fined a huge amount. And the terms and conditions will dictate that they will remove any material that's not safe. Guess what? That is a legal but harmful provision. And they haven't dictated an equally strong duty on those big tech companies to have a provision that they have to take into account free speech. And so, wait for it, their excuse for doing that is, oh, we're just a government. We don't want to start interfering in private companies' terms of service. But in fact, they are interfering in private companies' terms of service. That's what the whole bill is about. But they won't put an emphasis on free speech.
So those of us that are concerned with free speech, there is this question, isn't there, as you've just outlined, that they're actually effectively outsourcing censorship. There's the question of our own democratic decision-making sovereignty, effectively, being able to hold our own elected representatives to account. And in Britain, where so many people fought and died for freedom and freedom of speech, is now going to be decided on the mores of Silicon Valley in their terms and conditions, which can change at any time. I mean, as we've seen, haven't we, like with PayPal and Eventbrite and others, if you're not doing the what they consider to be the right kind of speech, if it's offensive, you wrote a book, a very good book saying, I find that offensive. If they find it offensive, then that can be silenced and closed down. So it's very dangerous, isn't it? Because it's a very subjective, relative idea and does very little to protect any sense of our ability to speak freely. So how do you think this is going to play out both in the Lords and the Commons from your point of view?
Well, I'm sad to say I'm a bit pessimistic. It's already gone through the House of Commons, which is, after all, the democratic part of the UK Parliament. It's now with the House of Lords, and we're not elected, but the job of the House of Lords is to scrutinise bills, but actually it ends up that the House of Lords tries to change quite a lot. And in this instance, of course, I'm going to be trying to stop, at least trying to amend the bill to introduce some free speech strengthening mechanisms and to look very carefully at something you've just talked about, which is they say that they're protecting speech that's democratically important. But when you actually look at the wording, what they kind of mean is during an election or just what politicians say. So they're protecting their own speech, but they don't mean the kind of politics that you're involved in, Alan. They're not talking about political activist speech. So we're going to be trying to, there's a few of us will be trying to amend it. One of the shocking parts of the debate in the House of Lords during the week was how few referred to free speech as an important issue. Hardly anyone, in fact, really just a handful of us. And the majority of people were saying that the bill is too weak, that it needs to be strengthened in terms of banning hate speech. And you've just mentioned this discussion about misogyny. A lot of people standing up saying, how can women go online? We feel unsafe. There's all this bullying and trolling and so on. I was thinking, God, I'm the one who gets it most, but I don't think that we should use that as an excuse for censorship. The conflation of young and old. I mean, so that we're talking about children one minute, it kind of slides into suddenly about adults. You know, at one point, one of the baronesses who spoke said, you know, childhood lasts forever. And, you know, it's kind of some rhetorical flourish, but you thought that is a tyrannical statement, because it effectively says that the state should look after us like children forever. And that's where it's dangerous. The other thing that was very worrying was that the minister in charge of the bill in the House of Lords, in his summing up, I thought he would at least say to us, oh, look, you know, there's a few of you worried about free speech, but don't worry about it. You know, it's we've got it, because they've mentioned the words free speech, you know, a couple of times in the bill, even though it's a very low level duty. He didn't actually even do that. So in his long summing up of the debate, he didn't mention the words free speech or free expression once, not once, which will indicate that the Conservative government have decided that free speech is absolutely not important in any of the concerns about this piece of legislation. So we've now got a long period of weeks and weeks of discussing this legislation. I'll do what I can. I think people like you and campaigners have got a job on your hands, because one thing that politicians do listen to, they rightly might be cynical about us lot twerping on in the House of Lords, but if they hear that there are members of the public who are demanding that this is not as draconian and censorious as it is, they might be more inclined to kind of think again. And they actually dropped the legal but harmful clauses because there was a backlash that was not just an official backlash, but was a backlash on the streets of the UK, and political activists such as yourself and other civil liberties groups made such a fuss.
Absolutely. We had a situation where all of us responded. In fact, the barrister Francis Hoare, on behalf of Together, put a submission in. We know that great campaigns like the Free Speech Union, Big Brother Watch, have all been doing that, whilst others have, of course, been calling for further restrictions. And I want to come on to that a bit, both about your points about young people, but also about the misogyny question. Just because we do it together, of course, ask everyone to do calls to action, to email and call MPs and the government and the cabinet. And that's really important, as you say. But, you know, this point about misogyny, it's very difficult to argue against it. Even when I posted this morning about it, you get this kind of moment where you think, oh, now, you know, some people saying that I think that it's great that women are abused or anyone's abused online. And obviously that's not something that I like. And I like civil discourse. I've actually been on a stream with you before where people started doing really disgusting things, like putting on pornographic images, calling you all sorts of names, but you handled it really well. You had handled it with comedy. You sort of argued back. And at the end of it, you weren't mortified. What happened was is that you won the actual conversation, it seems to me, with people. What's happened to that? That's my first question. What's happened to that kind of sense that that can be done, and that somehow that all those great, important battles and rights that were won for women, now we seem to be almost presenting women as though they're shrinking violets, and you know, whether it's dog whistles from, which I never see happening from building sites anymore, but whether those things happen, and I'm sure they still do, or whatever it is, what's happened to that sense that women, like all of us, are robust and all of that, and can handle these things, even though they might be deeply unpleasant?
Yeah, I think you're hinting at something that I was trying to sort of imply as well, which is that one of the problems is that if you sort of say that women need the same kind of protection as children, there's a real danger there, isn't there? I mean, you're basically saying that, you know, those are the arguments that we saw in the 19th century and before it, which was that women needed to be looked after by men. And if you think about all of the provisions, you know, women weren't allowed to wear short skirts, and they had to be chaperoned everywhere. You know, you couldn't, you know, the father figure or the brother or whatever would look after you until they married you off to the appropriate man who'd look after you, right? And the idea was that women were vulnerable, particularly vulnerable. And we're getting the same narrative being presented to us in the 21st century. It's very disconcerting to me, this idea that women need special protection. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there aren't, you know, a load of sexist prats out there in the world. And there is, particularly in relation to online social media, or any woman that's ever participated at any level who's got a bit of a profile, you know, the kind of insults you get tend to be particularly about you as a woman. And, you know, they will emphasize what you look like. I mean, they use the old sexist tropes, right? A lot of sexual, you know, kind of hints of sexual, not even violence, but, you know, sexually aggressive, usually insulting what you look like. That comes to me, but, you know, it's kind of like, you know, what kind of a woman am I? You know, And let me tell you, it's not nice, right? I mean, you could kind of read what's aimed at you, and you could, and of course, I'm an old woman, and I'm gutsy and I'm well experienced. So I do appreciate that if you're 19, 20, 21, and you're seeing this stuff, it's pretty unpleasant. But the question always is, what's the remedy? And I'm saying that what is much more dangerous for women is for the authorities, be that the government of any country, or be that the police, or be that the regulator in the UK terms, is this thing called Ofcom, which is going to be the Office of Communication, which is going to be given the most enormous powers in the UK, be the largest regulator in this country after this bill goes through. Are we saying that they should decide what we see and hear using the excuse of protecting us as women? Now, I might not like sexist, misogynist abuse, by the way, but I don't want the state to decide what I, as a woman, am allowed to interact in with online, that they decide on my behalf. That would be very dangerous and insulting to me as a woman.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to be going for a short break in just a moment, but I want to ask, and we can go in if you'll stay with me, Claire. We have seen that this government has promoted the idea of free speech on the campus at university. So there seems to be a real sort of schizophrenic approach to this about some free speech being okay and good and worthy and others not. And I'd like to unpick that a bit more, as well as get onto the public order bill. So if you'll join us after the break, I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. We'll see you in just a moment. Thank you.
TNT Radio's Jeremy Nell and Germ Warfare.
Russia, Ukraine, and of course, you spoke recently about the ships off the coast of South Africa. Let's start there.
This is fascinating because this scene was printed in the Washington Post, which everyone who follows foreign policy in the U.S. knows that the Washington Post is the CIA rag, and the New York Times is the State Department rag. But this was so important that they actually ordered the Washington Post to print it. So this was basically Tony Blinken having a conversation with one of the Washington Post hacks, which usually follows the CIA menu, and going around a sort of offer you can't refuse mafia style indirectly to the Russians. Because they are absolutely terrified about the is it happening, is it not happening Russian offensive, which could start tomorrow, next week, in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, next month, in 2 or 3 months, or never start at all. They don't know. So this is what we call strategic ambiguity. And the Russians, as very good chess players and diplomatic players, are masters of this game.
Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
A cashless society means zero cash. No car boot sales. No markets. No tooth fairy or piggy banks. No saving cash for a rainy day. No buying anything with privacy. Digital currency means every cent you receive will be recorded and every transaction tracked. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio. Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Well, the fuse is definitely lit for freedom. I'm here with Baroness Claire Fox. We're talking about free speech, the online safety bill, and we will be getting onto the public order bill. But we just broke, Claire, on the question of this kind of contradictory approach by the government. On the one hand, they say they want free speech in the campus and universities, and on the other, they sort of not upholding free speech. What do you think is informing this kind of uneven response and a lack of a principle, a lack of a sense of a universal idea of free speech?
Well, I think that one of the things that listeners might want to really consider is that it's very easy to be in a situation where we divide the world into woke and anti-woke, right? And it's become this sort of like, oh, we're the anti-woke crap. I mean, if I'm going to be in that division, I'm on the anti-woke side, fair enough, right? But it becomes a bit of a kind of cliche. And the government sometimes say, oh, we're on the anti-woke side and we can't stand all these woke snowflake students over there trying to cancel free speech on campus. And then they've brought a bill forward. And at a superficial level, I'd agree with them and their free speech, higher education, academic freedom bill. I'm very much supportive of attempts to ensure that academic freedom is protected on campus. But the problem is a much deeper one, which is if you actually look at the debate, it always says, do you want to be safe or do you want to be free? And we saw that during lockdowns, didn't we? And COVID, do you want to be safe or do you want to be free? And the problem is, historically, over the last lots of years, a lot of even liberal, lots of free speech type civil liberties crowd never won that argument. They didn't even try and have the argument. They tried to fudge it and compromise. And so I think that what happens is, as soon as people say the issue is safety, and that's what they're saying, the issue is the safety of where people, do you feel safe online? The government have boasted they want to be the UK to be the safest place to be online in the world. One very good peer made a quip and said, well, if I wanted that, I'd move to China. Because actually, we know that safety is often synonymous with censorship. Safety is often synonymous with, in order to be safe, we'll ban things then. We'll lock you down. We saw this throughout the lockdown period. They said, we're only locking you down to keep you safe. And because the words safety are deployed in relation to the online world, they say, we're only bringing in this bill to keep you safe. We're only going to censor things that will make you safe. We want to keep you safe. And I'm afraid it's not the government we need to be critical of, because, you know, who cares about them? It's ourselves, in a way. We've got to develop better arguments about why freedom, which is risky and does mean taking, you know, sometimes means exposing yourself to horrible ideas and people being insulting, and even maybe the risk of getting a virus if you go out, right, at a particular time. We've got to say that we don't want them to use safety to trump freedom.
And safetyism absolutely has become a key thing. And that's a session in and of itself. I think we could come back and talk hopefully at some point about it. Just how this relates, it seems at the moment that it's legislation. We've got laws and rules. We've got a public, we've got a health act. We've got lots of legislation in place to deal with criminal behaviour. Now, I know that perhaps many listeners here, many people in Britain undoubtedly are very frustrated and understandably so about having their ability to go to work or see their family or whatever disrupted by some types of protests that are seeking specifically to stop traffic and things like that, Just Stop Oil and other things like that, Extinction Rebellion. But there are laws already to deal with that, aren't there? And now we've got this public order bill that's come through, which also links to the free speech question, because we've seen journalists arrested on the basis of it. And apparently Suella Braverman now is being called on to assess that. But seeing all sorts of things like tagging people, seeing if they may, a bit like public space protection orders, there's protest orders, right? That if you might go to a protest, if you're under suspicion, that then you get prevented. It's a bit like Minority Report. It's very Black Mirror. Where are we with this? And what do you think is likely to happen with it?
So we're right at the, unlike the online safety bill, which we just discussed, which is just starting in the Lords, we're right at the end of the process in the Lords now on this public order bill. And you've hinted at it, Alan, but honestly, the police in the UK have got a huge arsenal of public order legislation and laws and rules and all sorts of things that they could use that could stop the most egregious forms of these new tactics deployed by Just Stop Oil or Extinction Rebellion and the environmentalists. And of course, bear in mind, I know this, those protesters, their tactic is to be as disruptive as possible to the public. I mean, they actually boast, we want to be a huge nuisance so that everybody's fed up with us, because they're kind of trying to bully the public into submitting to their net zero targets or whatever it is that we stop using fossil fuels. I completely disagree with them politically, and their tactics are antisocial and often anti-democratic because they're not interested in persuading anyone. They want to kind of, you know, annoy us to the point that we give in to them. But there's a funny bit here. First of all, Just Stop Oil have just announced that they're not having demonstrations anymore. Right? So that's right. So Just Stop Oil have said, we don't want to have we're not going to use these tactics anymore because they aren't working and we keep getting arrested. In other words, they've proved my point, which is we've already got the laws that could deal with them. I do think there is a policing crisis, though, because very often what's been most annoying is when the public go out, these people are gluing themselves to roads and not moving, everyone's trying to get to work, and the police are standing there like chatting to them and not arresting them. You think, for God's sake, get on with it. But that's not because they haven't got the laws. It's because there's a sort of crisis of policing where they won't effectively enact on those laws. So this new public order bill is entirely unnecessary, in my opinion. But it's got popular support because people think, well, if it's anything that we need to get rid of those Just Stop Oil types, it'll be useful. The point I was making in the House of Lords this week, which I think you'll be interested in, is that it doesn't. The point is, this piece of legislation doesn't say the words Just Stop Oil or Extinction Rebellion. It's just really draconian powers to the Secretary of State, the Home Secretary, and to the police to stop anyone protesting. So one of the worst aspects of this is what's known as serious disruption prevention orders. Serious disruption prevention orders, I stress the words. They also don't define serious disruption.
Right.
And when you get one of these orders, which you can get before you've ever been on a demonstration, and they're also bringing in associated with this suspicion-less stop and search powers, they actually say you don't need to be suspected of anything, but we can stop and search you in an area where there's a demonstration going on. Now, I would say, I listened to your show last week. Brilliant show, by the way. Loved it.
Thank you.
All of those people out protesting on low traffic neighborhoods, on the ultra low emission zones, ULEZ, on the 15-minute cities, huge concerns from the grassroots about the fact that local authorities are stopping you moving around the place. And what are we going to do about it? Hopefully, we're going to go out and organize and have demonstrations. And this piece of legislation that they're bringing in, people might think, oh, that's all right. That's meant for all those complete lunatics who are the net zero environmentalists. This piece of legislation will be used against everybody that wants to fight 15-minute cities. If you wanted to organize a demonstration or anything, you talked about the meeting in Bath. You could be on your way to that meeting in Bath with this new law. The local council could say, well, actually, it's going to be a protest, really. We've got to bring in suspicion-less stop and search and stop you. We'll search you. You might have your bicycle lock on you because you've got a bicycle, not because you're going to do anything mad with it, or even a phone, and they could say you're going to use that to mobilise people. And then they could say, we're not going to let you through. We're going to search you. Then we're going to issue you with a serious disruption order, which means you can't go on any demo for 2 years and you'll be criminalized if you break any of the rules about it. I mean, how mad is that? It's scary.
Terrifying. It's terrifying, Claire. And I've got to say, on a Saturday morning here in bright but chilly London, that's what put a chill through my spine, just thinking and contemplating about it, the way you've spelled that out, because it's not to have catastrophism, but I think it's really important to assess and evaluate what can happen. I'm astonished, and it might be worth it. We haven't got that much time, but to unpick this a little bit, because how has it come to be that, I mean, I know that the whole idea that many conservatives are not really conservative anymore, and within Labour, they don't have that much relationship with Labour, but the very principles, the core fundamental pillars of our society around the rights to freely assemble, for free speech, to do it peacefully, and question and criticise, are under enormous attack. And yet, we were, you know, there was a sense a few years ago that this could be a new flourishing moment where, you know, we could have a dynamic Britain, exciting, And that's gone. What do you think? I mean, it's a very difficult question to in a short period of time, but what's happened? Why is it that people now are just so scared of having these discussions? Why are they so scared about these kind of the rather banner debate? Surely if you're confident of your position, even authoritarians, if they're confident, they don't need to stop things like this, right? Because they go, well, we're right, here we go, you're wrong. And yet we've got these weak authoritarians, it seems, that just want to stop everything. What do you think is responsible for that?
Well, I you're right. I can't possibly go into all of the reasons, but I suppose one of the things is you just pointed out that I kind of painted a very dystopian picture, and I don't want to overhype this, even though I don't really find these pieces of legislation really scary. But their argument would be just in case. So it's a precautionary approach. So I'm not suggesting that even if this bill gets passed, which it will, by the way, it'll go through. They might amend it. It's slightly softer in the House of Lords, but it will go through. I'm not suggesting that every police officer will stop people on the way to Bath or the meeting in Bath, for example. What I'm saying is they'll have the power to do it, and they will say just in case. Now, one problem is for the Conservative government was until recently, it was so sort of full of itself with its 80 seat majority that it thought it could get away with this. Right. Of course, now they're likely to be voted out in 18 months, if the truth be known. And so it's always good to remind them that they might like giving this power to the Home Secretary, that they know who it is, but maybe they won't like it so much when the Home Secretary is in a different party and can use the same powers. And they do actually look a bit kind of like they go a bit white when you remind them that actually they might be one of the ones on the receiving end of this. But I think that precautionary principle of accruing law, not having any of the mechanism that they believe that they can persuade anyone of anything anymore. Political leadership has completely collapsed. And what do they grab? They grab a law. They think that the only way you can change anything anymore is to make a new law for it. And all sides of the political spectrum do this. And I'm afraid, as it goes, even political activists do it. Because very often people do a kind of tit for tat cancel culture. You know, it's like, you know, you've got the woke people are trying to cancel us. So what will we do? Oh, I know. We'll try and get them sacked. We'll do a bit of offence archaeology through their Twitter feed and see if we can find something awful they said when they were 18 and get them exposed and get them. Because we, instead of us having, all of us having the confidence to try and win arguments with people, we almost kind of treat each other as tribes, point each other out as the enemy, and then try and destroy each other. And that misses the key but very, very difficult task of trying to persuade one's fellow citizens to change their mind. You know, that's what we've all got to do a lot more of.
We're also seeing, that the government is pushing through legislation to try and limit and prevent striking. They'll say they're still not against the principle of being able to withdraw your labour, but effectively what they're saying is that if people have democratically voted to do something that's often seen as a last resort where people don't get pay and it's a very big thing, let's not be flippant about it, that they should be forced to go against their own democratic vote and go back to work. And again, it seems like a lack of confidence to be able to win hearts and minds and ideas. What I wanted to do is, because we've got a short bit of time now, and we've seen that with the Twitter files and also most recently, very worryingly, the recent piece of work that Big Brother Watch has done, where we've seen that the Digital Culture, Media and Sports, the department in the government and others in the cabinet have had spy units. I mean, the DCMS, I used to associate it with all the nice arts, and even though they had an agenda around all sorts of things like obesity and all of that, you think, what has happened that journalists and academics and other people have been highlighted and being spied on, right, as though we're enemy combatants? This is really problematic, is it not? And we really need to be able to get that stamped out.
Well, that's exactly the point, Alan. But it does relate to what I just said, which is the way that you now deal with your opponents is to discredit them, is to try and delegitimize them. And this is the government doing it. So they try and say, oh, we're going to spy on you. We're then going to label you as some sort of like deviant in, you know, all sorts of, you know, anti-vax, you know, we have blacklists and all the rest of it. We're going to discredit your reputation. We saw reputations being completely destroyed during the lockdown period, but this happens all the time. And, you know, people call you a transphobic bigot if you have the temerity to assert that women that being a woman is biological sex exists and so on. But they label you, right? People get labeled racist, bigots, conspiracists and all the rest of it, right? And it denies us of the language that we might need to describe real racism or real conspiracy theories or whatever, when everybody is just labeled. And that's what the government are doing. They're doing exactly the same thing. We've got to really fight against that, but we've also got to be critical of our own side and not do the same thing back. You know, there's no point just going, you woke snowflake. You've got to win the arguments with people. That's what we're trying to do at the Academy of Ideas, by the way. So I hope you'll check us out.
And the Academy of Ideas, definitely check out the Academy of Ideas. I've spoken there before. It's a really brilliant space that enables all sorts of free speech and lots of clash of ideas and lots of brilliant young people as well. And we'll post that afterwards on the show as well so people can see it. I want to thank Claire Fox. I haven't been a fan historically of the idea of unelected people in the House of Lords, because I always thought historically that was almost like, well, the great unwashed, the commoners can't do it all on their own and they need sort of stabilisation. But it must be said that watching Claire Fox's videos from the House of Lords has been a real inspiring moment for me to see some of that at least being out in the public domain. So I want to thank you for joining the show, Claire, and for your consistent work in spite of some trolling you, trying to scare you and terrify you, name call you and smear you. But you definitely demonstrate what it's like to be a strong leader who happens to be a woman as well. Thank you very much, Claire.
Thanks, Alan.
I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. We'll be with you right after the break. Thanks very much.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
Everybody is up in arms over the big balloon that's over the United States. How did it get there? All right, it appears to be of Chinese origin, and it appears to be drifting southeast across the United States. And it got me to thinking, this thing is way up in the stratosphere. It's a balloon. How the heck do you steer it? Maybe someone knows how to steer it, but I was looking at it going, maybe it just floated with the upper air winds. And taking a look at the upper air flow over the last 5 to 7 days, anything that originated in China would have come northeastward over Alaska, then turned southeastward over Canada, and is now over the United States. So we'll see. Maybe that actually happened. And if so, then you could say that the TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog diffused a global situation. Can't be as bad as global warming, or maybe it could be. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
One disease, millions of lives permanently disrupted. But Alzheimer's disease is taking more than memories. It's taking lives. What few realize is that Alzheimer's kills more people than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined. Everyone is at risk, even you. And everyone can help, especially you. We're the Alzheimer's Association, the brains behind saving yours. Join us.
Visit the Alzheimer's Association online at alz.org to find out more. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
This is the Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone around the world. This is TNT Radio. I'm Alan Miller, and I'm really pleased to be joined now by Cheyenne Roloffs, who's currently a PhD candidate in research psychology, who has a background in medical sociology, and as well as working in volunteer and community outreach projects, including working with youth, incarcerated teens. She is also currently serving in the Cambridgeshire Residence Group, demanding a transparent democratic process around the proposed congestion charge. And we've seen in the news that there are already some very big protests, which Cheyenne actually spoke at. Cheyenne, welcome to the show today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So just talk us through, please, if you will, because people are now getting really familiar with low traffic neighbourhoods, 15-minute cities a bit. They've obviously got congestion charging in different places, but what was proposed with Cambridgeshire and what's been your response so far?
What's been proposed in Cambridgeshire is quite draconian compared to what's happening across different parts of the UK. So they're basically suggesting that every automobile with a motor, so motorcycles included, motorcycles, cars, vans, and lorries, all of them be charged a fee from £5 all the way up to £50.
Right.
And this is everywhere within Cambridge City, which actually includes Addenbrooke's Hospital and spans quite a distance.
Now, how has the County Council and how has the Council actually approached this? What's gone on in terms of democratic engagement? How's it, you know, what are your concerns with it?
Our main concerns are that there were consultations that were implemented that not very many people knew about. And the most recent one was promoted by the GCP, which is an organization called the Greater Cambridge Partnership. It used to be the City Deal, which is hugely unpopular. So they basically rebranded it, turned it into the GCP. And now they're trying to basically push the same agenda forward. But with these consultations, as you were mentioning earlier on the show, they're all, you know, biased leading questions. They basically are formulated in a way that gets the outcome that they are looking for and what they want. And, you know, not many people know about them.
What we're seeing, Cheyenne, is that around the country, lots of ordinary people with all different sort of views that people have come. Some are still in Labour, some are ex-Labour, some are Conservatives, some are independents, Lib Dems, Greens. Many people are furious and outraged by these impositions, by the lack of democratic engagement. Tell us a bit about the protest you had, because you had several thousand people there. You spoke really well. We'll actually post one of the videos of you speaking after the show at some point. But just tell us what happened with the protest and the sort of people that are actually involved in challenging this in Cambridge.
Right. So we effectively started finding out about this, I believe, in around August, and it started getting promoted by change.org, a petition that was put up there. A group of individuals got together in a local pub, said we have to do something about this. They started organizing a protest for the 27th of November, a rally, and we really didn't expect that many people to show up, maybe a couple hundred. But we had, the police estimate that we had around 2,000 people show up at that rally. So you can see there was a huge amount of support for us compared to what was happening the following weekend when they organized a smaller pro-bus rally, which about 200 showed up at.
We've just heard from the Baroness Claire Fox about some of the measures that are being discussed in terms of public order bill and even further restrictions on the rights to congregate. It's obviously very concerning, right, that it seems that the people, elected representatives, whether they're at central government, who we should remind ourselves are funding many of these low traffic neighbourhoods directly, as well as 15-minute cities and other measures to really reduce traffic. Some people have called it a war on cars. It's a war on people to limit mobility. We haven't ever had a discussion about having to negotiate our mobility or to be constantly taxed, a bit like in feudal times, going from one place to the other. How would you say, like, what's the mixture of people that you've got involved with you in terms of residents, in terms of small businesses, car, you know, other types of people?
We have a very broad church. We've got people who, we have one councillor who's been helping us out. He's a former Lib Dem, but he actually stepped down when they wouldn't remove Addenbrooke's, and so now he's an independent. We've got conservatives. We've got people from the Green Party. We've got everybody from all walks of the political life. We also have high net worth individuals that are against this, all the way down to people who are really going to struggle if this charge is implemented. So we've got everyone.
You know, we've seen in Oxford that just in the last couple of weeks that businesses have had to close after being there for decades. We've also seen that in Haringey, right? You think London, it's highly densely populated, but Middleton Road, it's been there for over 100 years with small businesses. Tara Hawkins just had to close her business there. It seems strange, doesn't it, that we're in a cost of living crisis, that the whole idea of service provision, the idea of urban planning about housing and transport and improving services, is now one about taxing and limiting. In fact, in Oxford, they're going beyond the 15-minute city with a proposal on the 25th of February at the council, where they're going to go beyond the bus gates and the 15-minute city and start charging double amounts for key workers like nurses and school teachers and for parking. It's already unlivable or unaffordable for many people in Oxford. And you think in Cambridgeshire, basically it's a flat out tax and imposition that on the one hand raises a lot of revenues, and the other, it's got to be said, it's, and not just a nudge, it's active impositions to limit and restrict, and really seems to ignore the fact that people need to move around for all sorts of reasons. And one of the questions that they don't like to address is particularly for women, whether it's later at night when you want to leave somewhere in terms of what that means, or also in terms of being carers, having to see elderly and vulnerable, then of course people with disabilities on the school runs with kids at different schools and having to do shopping. Not to say obviously dads do that too, of course. This seems to be an all-out assault on the public, does it not?
Absolutely. And you can also see that, you know, that it's going to benefit those who are centralized in the middle of it. If you think of it like a giant donut, everyone who lives centrally and who can walk or bicycle is going to benefit from this. And everyone who lives on the outside and is further away from things, they basically really depend on their cars. And it doesn't matter how much of an improved bus transport system you bring in, you're going to have those individuals with more complex driving and transport needs are the ones who are going to suffer the most, whether or not they're, you know, carers or, as you said, or parents. This is basically an anti-family tax. And it's also very regressive. It's going to hit the poorest communities the hardest.
It seems like many of these measures also, ironically, are being made by county councils that don't necessarily live in the actual area they're legislating around. Is that the case here in Cambridgeshire?
That absolutely is the case. And I think I would like to add one more point onto there. Cambridge being traditionally a very small market town, it never had the industrialization never benefited from that. So we have very narrow and small streets. And Cambridge University also doesn't allow its students to have automobiles. And again, that's one of the groups that's allowed to vote. And so it doesn't matter to them whether or not cars are on the road. In fact, they'd probably prefer that they not be, but they're not allowed to have cars. So
there's sometimes a tale between two cities. We know this in Oxford as well, between the university and the broader residents. Of course, a dynamic city, a historical cultural city, one of very big importance of which Cambridge is, of course, with the university and everything else, has one that caters to all its residents and has one with a view to think about how we can be innovative and come up with solutions as opposed to just impose taxes. So tell us a bit about the next steps of your plans. I mean, we together think what you're doing is fantastic. We certainly support it. We're encouraging people up and down the country with free our streets and take back democracy to do it. But in a way, you're demonstrating the very thing that's really most interesting and remarkable at the moment, that as local technocrats and national technocrats try and suffocate and limit, it calls out this democratic spirit. They call us, you know, ignorant, stupid, lazy, whatever these terms might be, and then other sorts of smears. But actually, to me, it seems like it's bringing out the best in people from all walks of life, all ages, all mixture, very diverse, who are actually saying this is what democracy is about and we demand it. So tell us what your next steps are there, please.
Yes, so the consultation that the Greater Cambridge Partnership put forward ended the 23rd of December. And we know the results are up, but they're not sharing them. And there was one question 9 that asked point blank, do you want the charge or not? And they won't even publish the results from that. And we had a resounding, over 24,000 people responded to that consultation, which is incredible considering in prior consultations, they've had less than 1,000 or maybe 2,000 at the most. So what we're doing right now is we are organizing a big rally set for Sunday, the 26th of February. We're marching in from 3 different locations, very similar to what we did in November, and marching in from 3 locations, converging on Parker's Peace at 1 p.m. And that is meant to put pressure on the county and city councilors, for 2 upcoming votes that we're looking at. And just it's also to remind individuals they need to keep putting pressure on the government. They need to keep putting pressure on their counselors, because that's the only way that we see that we're going to have the vote that we want. And one more thing is that if you look at who the businesses that are supporting the GCP and their proposals, they're basically very large multinational corporations. If you look at our most recent leaflet that we've prepared right now to advertise the rally, we've got local businesses, small businesses, you know, the people that are going to hurt, be hurt the most, the hardest.
Absolutely. Well, calls to action are really important, getting everyone to email their local councillors and the MP. And also, we will be bringing it to Mark Harper and the Cabinet and the Department of Transport on all of these issues, because there's a bit of an umbilical cord there. I think everyone should note that day if you're in Cambridgeshire and in Cambridge, that's Sunday, the 26th of February. It's very, very important. I think that one of the things, it's got to be said, bravo, brava, well done, because it is really inspiring to see local residences and local businesses stand up. It takes courage. Often it's an exhausting process. We know that the council kind of uses our money to sort of do all sorts of things to not listen to us. You know, fun, it's in Bath when they had a consultation around Goodall Road. They only went out, so they had 99 respondents and 11 voted in favour of it, 12 voted against, and 5 said they did not know. And they said, well, that, we're going to take it as those 5 that did not know, that says, well, let's do it and let's put it in anyway. And you kind of see that attitude of utter contempt, a bit like what's happening with the people that are challenging ULEZ expansion and Sadiq Khan saying, well, that doesn't matter, I'm going to do it anyway. There's this sense, we're going to do it anyway. But you've got a great ground game already. And do you want to just tell people a little bit about how it came about, how you put it together? Because we're working with people with toolkits and how they can organize locally. Just tell us how it came about and how you did it.
This big rally that we're organizing in February.
We're just getting people together and getting the protest set up and that kind of thing. Just a very, very short overview.
So basically, I think a lot of people, we created a Facebook group, and a lot of individuals share news on the Facebook group. And if not, we have smaller community WhatsApp groups for those individuals who don't use Facebook or social media. And we've had a really healthy amount of support from just people on the ground who are spending their spare time on this, and also spare change. So we've got a few GoFundMe pages set up that we've where we've raised little bits of money to print our flyers advertising the rally. And then we also we give them a location where the flyers are at so that they can go and pick up flyers and mark the streets off that they plan on flyering. So it's a lot of people just on the ground working and volunteering their time.
The kind of approach to I want to get rid of cars is, as a long provenance, Ken Livingstone said it when he first did the C40 cities. He actually said it in 1999. He said, if I get in power, I'd love to do that. And then he set up the first C40 cities summit. And then that led on to Mike Bloomberg getting involved in 2005. In 2007, it went to COP21. It's now got put on steroids. Sadiq Khan is the chair of it. And we see these, people often talk about outsiders. They don't want outsiders coming in. They're organizing locally. They're nervous about that. But actually, these ideas and these policies are directly that. They're coming from outsiders nationally who are imposing these things that then locally they're taken up where lots of money is being generated. And rather than thinking about innovative solutions, how we live and work and play in better ways with a future-oriented idea, it's about limits and restrictions. So we very much encourage people to do just as you've done, right, and get involved, stand up together. It takes courage, so well done. We'd certainly be amplifying what you're doing and supporting you. If there's a message that you would want to give to any of the councillors or the MPs, bear in mind, everyone, councillors often get voted in by a few hundred people. We've already seen far more on your protest. They should take note of that. We keep reminding them of that. And MPs. And as this happens, and we also notify the main parties, and they see these things happening around the country, it's a bit like the March of the Millions. It's the Countryside Alliance did something similar, but they begin to realize just how many people are opposed to it. And in places like Ealing, residents have got them overturned. But what would you like to see the Cambridgeshire County Council do, and your MP? And just tell us who they are, if you would, just before we sum up.
The MP here in Cambridge is Daniel Zeichner, and he's been sitting on the fence with this. And so there's kind of, but we do have Anthony Brown as well as Lucy Fraser who are listening to their constituents and they are opposed. Any councillors that have been sitting on the fence, they have been saying effectively, this is how they get out of being responsible and taking a side, is they've been saying, oh, we're going to wait for the results of the consultation. However, Bridget Smith actually held back a vote to have this, have the data looked at by an independent surveyor. So basically it's going to someone that works with the council, works with the GCP and has been promoting their results to these consultations versus having someone from the outside do it and having a more balanced and transparent process. So what I'd like to say to the councillors and to anyone who's expecting votes, they're not going to get what they want unless they give us what we want.
Thank you very much, Cheyenne. I'm Alan Miller. We've got much more for you in the second hour. Please come back and join us. Congratulations. Well done. This is TNT Radio.